Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, where visitors can experience campus and learn about Luther's 60-plus academic programs, like engineering science, nursing, and music education. luther.edu/visit.
Support for WPR comes from the Dram Corporation, sustainable producers of OMRI-listed fertilizers for organic gardening and farming. Made in Algoma, Wisconsin. More information is at dramm.com.
It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A year ago tomorrow, Adam Lanza, age 20, entered Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, and fatally shot 20 children and 6 adults before taking his own life.
And today, of course, we are following the school shooting in Centennial, Colorado. The AP reporting right now that a student shot at least one other student before apparently killing himself. One other student was injured, but no details yet on that. But since the Newtown shooting, there's been a national conversation about gun violence, gun laws, and mental health issues. However, significant changes to national gun policy have not ensued since the shooting. Now, Vice President Joe Biden is announcing earlier this week that the Obama administration will be pledging $100 million to improve mental health services.
The Consortium for Risk-Based Firearm Policy also released a recent report that assesses the role mental illness plays in gun violence and offers policy suggestions for addressing the issue.
Here with us from the consortium is Beth McGinty. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health and a core faculty member of the Center for Gun Policy and Research. Beth, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first things first, I want to get into a little bit of what the study brought up, but I was very intrigued, you know, as I looked at the study, and it's a, you know, 30 some odd pages, about 11 pages of it are sources. And it was surprising to me that there has been so much research on the issues of mental health and gun use. There's nothing really new here.
No, so that's right. We did not conduct any new studies as part of our work with the consortium. We got together a group of national experts to summarize and come to consensus around the existing research in this area.
So tell me about the survey, how you undertook it, how you took that existing research and came to the conclusions that you did.
We initially had a large meeting in Baltimore earlier last spring in March of 2013, where we convened a face-to-face meeting of national experts in mental health, public safety, and also from the advocacy communities in mental health and gun policy, just to try to get everyone talking to each other and on the same page about what the research says. And so after that initial conversation, we began doing some in-depth work reviewing the literature with the goal of, number one, coming to consensus about what that literature says, and number two, making some policy recommendations based on the research evidence.
And that evidence, that word there is key, because throughout the report you see that phrase, evidence-based research. And I wonder if you could touch on that for a second, because, you know, in the last year, particularly right after Newtown, we heard a lot about mental illness and people with guns, but it seemed to be primarily from politicians and people who wanted to change laws and sort of take action now. And you're talking about taking action, certainly, but not necessarily from that political viewpoint. You're talking about evidence-based research. What is that?
So our goal was to formulate a set of policy recommendations that we as researchers feel are supported by the existing research literature. And so what that means is that prior studies have been done showing that certain groups of people, certain risk factors are at heightened risk of violence. So once we came to some conclusions about what those risk factors are, that was the first step in saying, well, we should make some policy recommendations to prevent people who have these risk factors, for example, history of violent misdemeanor crimes. That might be an area where states or the federal government could consider enacting some firearm prohibitions.
So let's talk about the recommendations of the consortium. You back two very distinct paths going forward. So let's take them one at a time. And let's start with the first recommendation.
Sure. So one of the first things that came up in this group was something that perhaps might be surprising to a lot of members of the public, and that was that while mental illness, particularly serious mental illness, can in some cases lead to violence, the reality is that the vast majority of people with mental illness are never violent, and that the vast majority of gun violence is not caused by mental illness. Only about 4% of gun violence in the U.S. is caused by mental illness. So our first recommendation was that rather than trying to prevent sort of a broad sweeping group of people with mental illness from having guns, we should focus on the small subgroup of people with untreated serious mental illness who are at certain times in their lives at heightened risk of having guns, particularly the people who are involuntarily hospitalized for mental illness. And federal law already tries to prohibit people in this group from having firearms, but we made a series of recommendations to strengthen that federal policy and also a recommendation for states to expand and clarify their policy around involuntary hospitalizations, and firearm prohibitions.
And recommendation number two takes a look at evidence-based risk factors for violence.
Correct. So after we came to the conclusion that mental illness is not a primary cause of gun violence in the United States, we started to look at, well, what are some of the other risk factors? And we came to the conclusion that other risk factors supported, again, by the research evidence for violence include history of violence, so violent misdemeanor crimes, domestic violence, and things like substance use, drug abuse, or alcohol abuse. And so our recommendations are that states could consider prohibiting firearms, perhaps for a temporary period, in people with criminal convictions related to those evidence-based criteria. So convictions for violent misdemeanors, convictions for domestic violence, convictions for multiple DUIs or DWIs.
So now you've got these two recommendations out there. You've made them. What now? What happens next?
Well, what happens next is that we are working with policymakers at both the state and federal levels to educate them about these recommendations. And we have gotten a lot of interest, particularly from states who are interested in trying to take some action in this area and understand what the research evidence actually says and what policy proposals are supported by the research.
Now, early on, you said that a lot of people will be surprised by that first recommendation dealing with the role that mental health issues play in gun violence. And I imagine the surprising part is that your research shows that it doesn't play a particularly big role. But yet, so many of these high-profile cases that we see involve mental illness of some kind. How do you separate those two things?
Yeah, so we see these large national tragedies that just capture the hearts and minds of the country and are so important and shattering, frankly. But the reality is that while mental health has been a factor in some of those shootings, when we step back and look at most of the gun violence in the U.S., so over 30,000 gun deaths per year, that gun violence often doesn't make the headlines in the way that mass shootings do, but it has a huge burden on our society. And the vast majority of that gun violence is not caused by mental illness.
We are talking with Beth McGinty, and she is an assistant professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health and a core faculty member in the Center for Policy and Research. And we're talking with her about the issues surrounding guns and gun violence. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferrich. We'll move on to a new topic. Thanks to Beth McGinty for joining us. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A case in Texas has sparked a national debate about the risks associated with being upper middle class or affluent. Attorneys for a 16-year-old from a fairly wealthy and influential family said he was blameless for killing four pedestrians while driving drunk because of his affluenza.
That's a term used to describe the ill effects of being raised in an affluent family situation and the consequences of being brought up without enough limits from parents. Now, the judge accepted the arguments of the defense and gave the teen 10 years probation instead of incarceration. So that, in turn, got us thinking, is affluenza real? Are there risks associated with being affluent?
Here with us to discuss affluenza is Sunia Luther, a psychologist who has studied upper-middle-class children. Her research was done while she was at Teachers College at Columbia University. Sunia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So we did kind of a little definition of affluenza there. Can you expand on that? Tell us what affluenza is, please.
Well, first of all, affluenza is not a scientific term. It's a colloquialism. It's a catchy phrase, if you will, to refer shorthand to the risks that are associated with an upper middle class affluent lifestyle. So it is not certainly not a scientific term in the DSM.
What, unscientifically, I guess, what have people characterized as the defining characteristics of affluenza? Or is it so, I guess, diluted by different people's interpretations that it means a lot of different things to different people?
Well, no. Affluenza, as I said, is a key phrase. But what is accurate about what these folks have said is the fact that there are, in fact, a heightened set of risks associated with an upper middle class lifestyle. As you'd mentioned, we have been studying white collar professional families, children from these families across the country over the last 15 years, urban areas, suburban areas, public schools, private schools, and so on. And the bottom line is essentially what we found is that among these affluent youth, the likelihood of finding serious adjustment disturbances, especially around use of drug and alcohol, but also depressive anxiety problems, rule breaking. The likelihood of finding serious adjustment difficulties among our kids, upper middle class kids, is substantially higher than the likelihood of finding the same problems among the average American population.
So that might sound counterintuitive. The idea would be they have it pretty good, life is pretty easy, so they shouldn't have problems. What are people looking at as causes of those various adjustment difficulties that you're talking about?
Excellent question. Let's start with substance use, which, as I mentioned, is probably the thing that we found most consistently to be elevated. Several factors involved here. One of the things that the kids most commonly talk about is that they use substances as a way to blow off steam, that the pressures to achieve and accomplish and be one step ahead and make that stellar resume to get into that top-notch college. All these pressures become so much that eventually they on weekends, they say, let their hair down in a big way. And there's a lot of binge drinking and substance use and so on. So pressures is one thing. A second thing is, very simply, they have the means. They have the money to buy the alcohol and the drugs, to buy the fake IDs of stellar quality, the cars to drive drugs and alcohol around, and to have parties at a moment's notice. So money is a second thing. A third thing is the peer culture. What we're finding more and more is that among upper-middle-class kids, social get-togethers tend to be organized around drinking and use of weed. So that the peer culture then also serves to reinforce the youngsters' tendencies to want to use substances. And the last thing is, unfortunately, in some instances, there are parents who tend to look the other way, that they are aware, yes, my son has a case of vodka or came home smelling funny. But the reaction is, well, kids will be kids. And unfortunately, the more we look the other way, the more likely it is that these problems will escalate.
Going beyond that last point, I've seen the case made that not only in some cases are parents looking the other way, they are bailing the kid out, literally or figuratively. The kids know the parents have their back. They're going to advocate for them and they're going to help them get out of trouble.
Excellent point. And it's not figuratively, it's literally. So in one of our most recent studies, we had given the kids a series of vignettes about things that they could have done that got them in trouble. And one of them was, imagine that you were caught at school for the third time with vodka, and the principal threatened to turn you into to report this to the police. How likely is it that your parents would object? And what we found was that one of every five kids, in fact, a little more than that, more than 20% of the kids said that more likely or definitely their parents would object. So it's not just this is not just figuratively. The kids honestly believe that the parents would come and fight to make sure that they stayed out of trouble with the school or with law enforcement authorities.
So is there something to that? If I believe growing up that my parents have got my back, I don't need to worry about the consequences of my own behavior, and that is going to get me into trouble down the road?
Well, if you think about what is it that keeps kids from misbehaving or keeps kids from getting into trouble, obviously the first line of action is us, the parents. Second line of action is perhaps the school. And third line of action is law enforcement. And if children believe that school and law enforcement are going to be overridden by parents, the parents are going to say, not to my child, you don't. What does that leave in terms of less? What does that leave the child in terms of a motivation not to indulge in this sort of thing?
Now, we don't want to paint too broad a brush, right? This isn't something that characterizes every single kid from this upper middle class background, is it?
I am so glad you asked me that, because absolutely not. We are not, I do not want to create any impression that children, even in general, leave alone all of the children. It is not true that upper middle class kids in general are either unhappy or doing drugs and alcohol. All we're saying is that in this population, there's an unusually large percentage of kids who are showing these problems. So that if, for example, 7% of the average American teenager show problems of, let's say, excessive high levels of depression, anxiety, we're likely to find more like 14 or 15%, even 20% among our kids.
Interesting. There's I think a sense, especially with this case that we referred to in Texas, this drunk driving case, of resentment that people from this background, a different set of laws or apply to them, or at least the laws don't apply to them equally as to everyone else. Somebody from a lower class background might not get away with the same thing that a kid from an upper middle class background gets away from. How does that factor into all this?
It's interesting you should ask that. I just heard on the news, and I'm not sure but this is entirely accurate, but what I heard was the same judge who was involved in this case had apparently a year or so ago had sentenced an African-American 14-year-old who had struck somebody in the head. The person fell down and passed away. This 14-year-old was apparently sentenced to 10 years in juvenile detention.
Whereas this drunk driving accident got only probation, not a prison term.
Was not just a drunk driving accident. It was first theft from the store of a couple of cases of beer. It was driving under the influence. It was having several people in the back of a pickup truck and a serious accident involving the loss of four lives. So you're looking at 10 years of probation for the one death caused by this 14-year-old African-American child, as opposed to 0 years of detention. I'm sorry, I meant detention, as compared to 0 years of detention. In this case, with the four deaths involved.
So I think a lot of people might look at this behavior that you're talking about and say, it's the parents' fault. This is a failure of parenting. Is that accurate?
Parents are absolutely involved, but parents are one part of the equation. We do, there's a certain amount that we are charged with. There's also some place where schools step in. A big part, as I mentioned earlier, is the peer group. We have come to a point where get-togethers among upper middle class, high school kids, sometimes even junior high school kids, the expectation, the norm is that there is going to be alcohol and there's going to be beer pong and there's going to be people getting drunk.
So, but I mean, again, presumably there's a parent somewhere who owns that house. They ultimately are responsible there, aren't they?
Absolutely. And yes, parents do need to be vigilant. And there is absolutely no excuse for this sort of condoning parties of this sort where there's alcohol flowing in your own home. All I'm trying to say is there is a culture that is built up outside of one's own home. And it is a strong culture. There's great reinforcement that these young people give to each other for the use of drugs and alcohol. And we, as it's an uphill battle. It's a big task for us as parents to be able to counter that in a reasonable fashion.
We're talking to psychologist Sunia Luthar. She's a psychologist who has studied upper middle class kids about the risks associated with being affluent. And we're talking about the concept of affluenza. And she says for a variety of reasons, these kids from an upper middle class background, some of it's pressure, some of it's a lack of consequences for behavior, a lot of things going into it, they are more prone to things like substance abuse, depression, and just doing things because they think they can get away with it. We're prompted by this case in Texas that we were just talking about, a young person involved in a drunk driving fatality, killed four people in this accident, getting 10 years of probation. His defense used in part an affluenza-based defense.
And we'd like to hear from you, too, as you listen to this program. What do you think about the idea of the risks being associated with being upper middle class? Do you think such a thing as affluenza is really real? And if so, what should we do about it? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 if you'd like to join in, if you've got a question or a comment for our guest. 800-642-1234. You can also email us. That address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The news is next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now about the concept of affluenza after it was used in a legal defense in a fatal drunk driving case. That's gotten a huge reaction in the media and online. Our guest is psychologist Sunia Luthar.
So we'd like to hear your thoughts on affluenza. As you think about it, do you buy it? Do you think it's something that's real that you can attribute something to? What risks do you think there are with being upper middle class? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us. That address is talk@WPR.org.
To your calls now, we have Dave on the line in Wanakee. Hi there, Dave.
Yeah, hi. It seems to me that what's happening is that the judge was giving in to the boy's sense of impunity. And that's nothing new when it comes to the wealthy or the powerful. They get a break all the time. And if you had a kid in the same situation who was poor, he would be in jail and he'd have a long sentence. It seems obvious to me.
Gotcha. Thanks for the call, Dave. And let's run with that a little bit. It seems like you could imagine somebody making a similar case for somebody who is low income, parent working two jobs and can't enforce rules. You could make a similar symptom or cause that sounds like affluenza for a different class. But would that hold up in a court, do you think? Sunia.
Are you asking me?
Yes, Sunia.
Oh, look at history, look at the precedents. It hasn't held up in court. I'm sure there have been cases where attorneys have argued for the history of kids from impoverished backgrounds that they had very, very difficult lives, and so they ought to be given some sort of break. It's rare. I would like to see instances where they have been let off going to juvenile detention and instead been given probation. Let me just add to this. Before the break, you had asked about parents, and aren't parents responsible? If you take a step back and look at what the justice system is doing here, this is a message from the legal system to upper-middle-class youth who we know are vulnerable to excessive use of alcohol and drugs, saying that, yes, if your parents are powerful and wealthy enough, you could get off scot-free. You can buy. You can walk your way through the legal system and really not have to have any serious consequences. That, to me, is very frightening, the message to young people today.
Thanks for the call, Dave. We'll go now to Derek in Round Lake, Illinois. Derek, hi.
Yes, hi. Thank you for a very important program. I work with the court system here in Illinois, and I think what a lot of people tend to not remember or understand is that courts often reflect the society at large. I'll look at it a little bit more, I would say, analytically, stating that basically with a lot of different things which are happening with the court system, cut funding, what have you, in a very competitive electoral process for judges, specifically the past several years with the Citizens United, lots of money going into judicial races. Judges are people too, and they also make political calculation depending how the situation really evolves itself. So I think we are in a situation where you see a lot of those type of contradictions where the wealthy would definitely get a break or be basically let off scot-free, while the people who really have no interest in to contribute to the political system are going to get, you know, short end of the stick. So I think it's really situation in the current case you're talking about. It's really more of a symptom of the disease than the disease itself.
Derek, thanks for the call. So he's saying the justice system is elected in part by wealthier people and reflects their interests, I guess.
I think the point is very well taken, and there's another point that's linked to that, which is that the welfare, the kinds of rehabilitation services that would be available for low-income youth are A, overcrowded, and B, not necessarily of such high quality, and C, certainly would not keep a child there for a year. So that we've got two problems going on. It's not just the political system and elected judges who are elected by the wealthy, but also even if a judge were to say, here, child, go have 10 years of probation instead of going to detention, where would that child go?
All right. We'll go back to the phones now with Marianne in Eagle River. Hi, Marianne.
Hi. I just believe that there should be some standardized thing given to judges for judgments, so that one person that gets a DUI and one is the rolling stop through a stop sign, they get something way different in a judgment. Sometimes I think when people have a lawyer with them, which of course would probably be that they have more money, they seem to get a lighter sentence. I've sat in court and listened and couldn't believe the judgments that came out. There should be a standardized thing. If you do this, you get that, like a rolling stop or a DUI.
Gotcha.
And then, of course,
thanks for the call, Marianne. So I guess less discretion for judges and judge it by the crime only. But it seems like there might be problems with that, too. Any thoughts on that, Sunia?
Well, there are always circumstances, as were used in this case, to explain why or how the child got to be in that case. But as your caller said, there are obviously, even for a low-income child, like the one who was sentenced to 10 years in detention, I'm sure there were extenuating circumstances or things that we could use to explain that. I'm not sure if they were put forth in court or they were taken into consideration to the same degree as they were in this case. To that degree, I do agree with your caller.
We have Pam with us in Chippewa next. Pam, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I just wanted to say, and I'm listening to all the callers, they seem very well educated and well informed about this matter. But I just wanted to say, my opinion is, this is crazy. That person should be made to accept responsibility for his actions, no matter what his income is, or no matter how much money his parents make. You know, this sense of entitlement really makes me angry, and it makes me angrier if it's used as an excuse for people not to face their responsibility.
All right. Thanks for the call, Anne. Sunia, I want to spend our last couple minutes talking about solutions at different levels. First of all, to prevent what we're calling affluenza, to prevent the problems and the risks associated with growing up affluent. Let's start with parents. What should they be thinking about if they're in this situation?
Well, let me see if I can reel them off really quickly. Number one, keep the levels of pressure low. This huge emphasis of you have to achieve, you have to excel, you have to be a star, you have to get into that top-notch college, and that you have to do at all costs. Watch out for that. Number two, keep your channels of communications open with your child. Have an honest set of conversations. Number three, please do not look the other way. When you get a sense that your child is getting involved in a lot of drugs and alcohol, it is a huge mistake, because what you see is probably the tip of the iceberg.
And how about at the institutional level, maybe the schools?
It's a tricky one at the institutional level. We've actually worked with a couple of schools where they have rather draconian measures if they find students even at a party where there is alcohol, expulsion, suspension. what tends to happen is when these youngsters get into college, then they sometimes veer towards extensive, like binge drinking. So there has to be some sort of acknowledgement that developmentally, by the time a child is in senior in high school, there is going to be some experimentation. But the truth is, wherever you draw the line, the child is going to go one step further. We need to be careful about what we say is allowable and what is not.
And at the mental health care level, you started by mentioning that affluenza is not really a diagnosable condition. It's not in the DSM. It's a colloquial concept. Should it be, or should something like it be in the DSM, the manual for mental illness?
No, I don't think it should be in the DSM. But what it should be is recognize families like ours, like yours and mine, basically educated people, white-collar professionals, we need to understand this is our children we're talking about. The risks are real. This is not just one sample or two samples. We've replicated this. The risks are real for extensive involvement in alcohol and drugs, problems of depression, anxiety, and problems of mindless delinquency, rule-breaking for no apparent reason. We have to be aware that our children are at risk.
Sunia, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
That was psychologist Sunia Luther.
Coming up, our WPR's Noah Ovshinsky joins us to bring us up to date on the top news in Wisconsin, including some key legislation signed this week on landlord-tenant laws, along with public access to a proposed iron mining site in northern Wisconsin.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up, is the United States ready for a woman president? And what would it take to make that a reality?
First, it's time for our weekly roundup of the top news going on in Wisconsin with our news guy, WPR's Assistant News Director, Noah Ovshinsky. Noah, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be here. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And happy Friday, by the way.
Yeah, it is Friday.
Yeah.
Well, the governor has been busy this week. He signed a whole bunch of legislation that lawmakers had passed a while back. We can't 20 or more, right?
Yeah, 20 plus. I think at last count it was 25 bills signed.
Okay, well, we can't hit all of them. We'd be here a long time. But let's hit some of the key pieces.
So there are a few that I'd like to outline, mainly because I think they were controversial, mm-hmm. And ones that people have been paying a lot of attention to. One deals with the controversial proposed mining site in the Pinoki Hills. There was some debate as to whether or not the state government should control access because of protests earlier this year, where protesters came to the mine and harassed the workers and things like that. And so the governor just signed legislation that establishes basically a 600-foot barrier around, you know, things that you need for mining, roads, equipment, that sort of thing.
And who would enforce this?
Well, you know, the DNR obviously would be in a position to enforce it. They also, under this legislation, have the power to, you know, close off, you know, more land if they find that the situation has actually become unsafe for, you know, the mine workers or for the public in general. When this legislation was initially proposed, it basically would have closed down a lot of land. I mean, I think like 3,000 plus acres around this proposed mining site. So as opposed to blocking out all this land to public access, they're just creating this barrier.
Kind of a buffer zone.
Exactly, exactly.
This is one of the many sub-controversies of the bigger controversy of the iron mine. Is either side happy with this? The mining company had wanted more. Opponents obviously wanted not at all.
Right, exactly. I mean, I think this is probably middle ground, my guess. Both sides will find a reason not to like it. People are very passionate about this issue.
And will continue to be, I'm sure. What other ones did you want to highlight today from what the governor signed?
Yeah, the other one, this is actually the second session in a row that the legislators have spent a lot of time on this sort of landlord-tenant relationship. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, big deal in a lot of the towns here in Wisconsin that have, you know, their college towns, you know, Madison, La Crosse, you name it. Most of the towns here in this state have a campus in them. So this is one of those issues that is always a hot topic. And basically what this bill did, the bill that the governor just signed, it makes it easier for landlords to dispose of any property that an evicted tenant leaves behind. And it also lets landlords tow, you know, parked vehicles without first calling police.
And this one was seen as a win for landlords,
definitely,
a loss,
yes,
for tenants' rights groups.
Exactly, right, exactly. And, you know, before, the landlords would have had to call the police in order to tow parked vehicles. Now they don't have to. This is definitely a win for the landowners, the landlords.
And these are both these pieces of legislation passed by the Republican majority.
Yes.
Jeff, what was the – I don't remember how Democrats – were they – was it a strict party line vote on those?
I can't say for sure, but I'm sure there were Democrats who were against it.
And then one piece of legislation that he didn't sign, still waiting.
Yeah, so there's at least one piece of legislation sort of hanging out there that we don't know when or if the governor will actually sign it, and it has to do with Native American mascots. And again, this is another controversial piece of legislation, and basically what it does is it makes it easier for school districts to keep Native American mascots, even if members of the public object to them. And the governor has, I believe, until the end of next week to sign it, or else I believe it, if he doesn't act one way or the other, it automatically becomes law.
And under the current system, one person could bring it to the Department of Education, and then they would review it, decide if the school could keep the mascot. Now
right.
The bar is much higher.
The bar, that's exactly right. There is a process in place. Under this new legislation, there still will be a process in place. But as you say, the bar will be much higher in order to change these mascots.
Is there, I don't know if we have a sense of whether he's going to sign it or just let it pass unsigned. A lot of controversy on
yeah,
this one.
Yeah, he hasn't said, there's really isn't, I don't think anybody really has an idea other than maybe the governor or a member of his staff.
And a lot of us have hunting on our minds. One piece of legislation there.
Yeah, one piece of legislation he signed actually creates a crossbow season, something that we have not had. And, of course, the license in order to do it. And basically what it does is it establishes the season and the license. And in this case, the archery season, it goes with the archery season. They'll be concurrently done. And in the past, only people who met certain criteria could actually use a crossbow to hunt. Now it's open to everybody.
Okay, so more crossbows out there in hunting season. Moving away from what the governor signed this week and getting back to the mining issue, the Harvest Camp, we've been covering a lot. Mike Simonson, a reporter up in that area, has spent a lot of time tracking the progress. First, remind us what the Harvest Camp is.
Right. So a Harvest Camp is a camp that the Lac-Couturier have set up, and it's been there now. This is county forest land, by the way, in the area near the proposed mining site. And it's an area where they've done a lot of cataloging of the environment's natural features, animals and plants and that sort of thing. It's been very controversial because they've been in this county land for a long time, and there are members, there are officials there in Iron County who would like to see them leave this forest land.
And there have been some developments now, and they're still ongoing. What
right.
happened this week?
Right. So earlier this week, the Forestry Committee in Iron County actually voted to evict the Lac-Couturier from this harvest camp.
So this is a committee of the Iron County Board.
Mm-hmm.
So what's next now? Is it going to go to the full board?
Yeah, well, the vote had come after the county and the tribe had been negotiating really for months, and apparently to no avail. And the LCO, the Lac-Couturier tribe, argues that they have the right to conduct research. County officials claim they're essentially just camping.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're just camping, if that's the case, then they should be evicted. The full board was supposed to take this up early next week, but I just found out from Mike Simonson, and as you may have just heard during the newscast, actually, that it has actually since been taken off the agenda.
Okay, so that's still hanging out there. If they did end up meeting and voting to evict, then what?
Right. So if the board does vote to evict, and officials indicate that they may take this up again early next year, so this issue definitely is not over. If they do, then the county corporate council must get an order from a court in order to evict them. And one of the reasons that has been given for this delay of taking it off the agenda is so that they could really assess what their legal exposure is if the county decides to evict the tribe from this forest land.
Okay, and Mike Simonson up in Superior is going to be watching this one, I bet.
Very close eye, keeping a very close eye on it.
Well, you reminded me, off my radar, we've got some kind of election coming up next year in Wisconsin.
Yeah,
a few important seats, I gather, governor, and our congressional delegation. is up, of course, for re-election, and some news there this week.
Yeah. So in election news, the first person to challenge Congressman Sean Duffy has actually stepped forward. Kelly Westland, who's an Ashland city councilwoman and a small business owner, held a press conference this week where she announced she was running against him.
And did she say why, what her focus was in this race?
Well, she said if she's elected, she will focus on raising the minimum wage. That would be a priority for her. And during the campaign, she says she will focus on Congressman Duffy's role in the partial government shutdown. Of course, he was in support of the government shutdown, as well as other budgetary matters.
Now, this seat is important. We've got a bunch of seats that are basically safe seats for either party. This one, Democrats have their eye on. Congressman Obie held it forever, pert near. And then Republicans managed to take it when he retired. Do Democrats have hopes of taking this one back?
I think they do. I think this is considered a seat that is competitive. How competitive it is, we really don't know at this point. But polling by left-leaning organizations show that that his approval numbers in his district are very soft. And so I think at least the Democrats are looking at this as a potential pickup for them.
Mm-hmm. I was just checking the numbers of the last two elections, though. Congressman Duffy won over Julie Lassa pretty handily, over Pat Kreitlow a little more handily, but you're saying latest polling, Democrats are reading the tea leaves saying they do have a shot here.
Yeah, according to polling that they cite and some left-leaning organizations, I believe it was MoveOn.org as well as Public Policy Polling. I think they had his approval ratings somewhere in the 40s, mm-hmm. something like that. So they consider it really a soft at best.
And, of course, you announce that you're running for office and the opposing party reacts within seconds usually these days.
Yes. And the Republican Party of Wisconsin was quick with a press release after she made her announcement. The party officials said, quote, that she would be nothing more than a blank check for Barack Obama. So, again, this is an attempt to connect her candidacy with the president, which the Republicans here in the state think might be a winning formula for them.
Democrats have shied away from primaries in that race, I think. Any indication that there might be somebody else or too soon to tell on that?
Yeah, Democratic officials also sent out a release saying, you know, they were happy to hear about the candidacy, but they did not say whether or not there would be a Democratic primary at this point. Nobody else has come forward, so that's very much an open question.
We mentioned the DNR earlier, and they've made some news this week. The board, I gather, the DNR board met and made some recommendations. What was on their agenda?
Yeah, so they tackled a few things this week, one having to do with wildlife. The DNR, the board voted to expand the area that bobcats actually can be hunted. Now, as it currently stands, the area that they can be hunted is roughly north of Highway 64. Mm-hmm. Now, if the legislature agrees with the DNR board, a zone would be created south of that border so that the bobcats could be hunted south of Highway 64. Basically, officials say the population is healthy and it's expanding and that it makes sense to expand the area where they can be hunted in limited numbers.
Okay. A couple other highlights from the DNR?
Yeah. The DNR board also agreed to ban hunting and trapping along an expansion of the Oak Leaf Trail in Milwaukee County. Now, neither of those things are allowed right now because the trail runs through some pretty populated areas, but they had to get this done bureaucratically. They had to make it official in order to capture some funding that would make the trail expansion possible.
Looking ahead, any big things you are looking to cover in the next week or two?
Yeah, we talked about it briefly last week, but I think it's worth mentioning again, the Farm Bill, the 2008 Farm Bill, which was supposed to be passed by now. It has not been. The Congress just passed an extension that will get us through early next year. Basically, it's just an extension of current farm policy. It, you know, from all accounts, it's looking like Congress might actually pass a new farm bill. It might even happen in January. There are some congressmen involved in the agriculture committees, both in the Senate and the House, who are indicating that they are very, very close to a deal. So certainly for the first time in a long time, I'm actually feeling kind of optimistic about Congress passing a farm bill here in the near future.
Well, those of us who either grow or eat food will be keeping an eye on that one. Noah, thanks a lot for joining us.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
That was WPR Assistant News Director Noah Ovshinsky.
Coming up, a look at the prospects for a female president of the United States. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.